Thank you all for coming. I want to thank Pastor Junho for the opportunity to stand here before you again, because I do that every second year or so. And somebody asked me the other day, how do I do the timing? Each time I come, I follow something that happens over there. That's not a question, because the chances that something will happen each time I come are very big anyhow. So it's not because I'm coming, something happens in the Middle East. Always something happens in the Middle East. And there's always a good opportunity to share about what's going on. The plan, as you heard, is we'll take about an hour and a half, 15 minutes, an hour and a half total. And if you have any questions after that, for as long as you need me here, I'll be more than happy to answer your questions. It's not an easy message to deliver, what I would like to deliver tonight. Not an easy message to hear. And I'm sure that some of you listened to the same message about 2 years ago when I was here last. So many things happen, and every day something happens in the Middle East, especially in light of what happened in Gaza recently. So this is maybe a good time to go over some of the issues over there and to try to point out some of the turning points. We cannot go into details, obviously. And if I have enough time, later on we'll bring in maybe the second circle. Now Lebanon, Syria, maybe Iran, all depends on how much time we have. So we'll cover the hour and 50 minutes, and then I'll see how many of you are sleeping and how many of you are taking a deep nap, and then we'll decide how do we carry that on. In order to share what I would like to share, we need to start with a couple observations. By the way, lots of information will come on the screen over there. And as the information comes, you have a triple challenge: to try to get used to my accent. Number two, to try to read the information. And sometimes what I'm saying is not well synchronized with what you see, which is going to make it even more complicated. Couple of observations: that everything you're going to hear tonight are based on what you're going to hear for the first couple of sentences. Number one, very important. If you thought that the Middle East is a place that had always a political conflict, you're wrong. Until about 90 years ago, the aftermath of the First World War, there were no nations in the Middle East, there were no countries in the Middle East, there were no national aspirations in the Middle East. The whole Middle East was part of a Muslim empire called the Ottoman Empire. That's modern-day Turkey. No countries, nobody spoke about a political issue. The countries of the Middle East were created by the parties that won the First World War, not because the locals wanted to be part of nations, because the British and the French and the Americans and the Russians had some interest in the Middle East. You know, it's a funny dynamic. Why would a nation fight for its independence? Well, it's a stupid question, right? Well, because a nation wants to be free, and maybe they are conquered by somebody else, they fight for the freedom, and they celebrate their independence. Not in the Middle East. In the Middle East, the nations were created not because the people fought for their freedom. The nations were created because Britain and France had a political interest to create nations against the will of the locals. Now think about it for a minute, how strange of a situation we're talking about. The Middle East always lived in clans, in tribes. The whole idea of nationalities did not exist until recently. Which is, if you want to create a nation, you need to take a few tribes, paste them together, and give them a title, a nation. This nation was formed against the people that became part of this nationality. So how come such a nation function if nobody wants to be part of it? Under one condition only: fearing the regime. Only if the regime is a brutal dictatorship, there is a chance that all these elements that were brought together against the will cooperate and will function as a nation. And sometimes we come today, the West, to bring a noble idea like democracy, not fully understanding what was the making of the Middle East like. Because as long as the Middle East was ruled by those dictators, and we all hate dictatorships, it was quite a stable place. Once you remove them and you want to give the people the right to vote, you should anticipate what might be the outcome. People will disintegrate to the clans and extended families and tribes that they used to live like long before they were created as a nation. So we need to be a little careful to what extent we do want full democracy in the Middle East. The fact of the matter is, it's not really working. It might work, but at the moment it's not really working. Because if you remove Saddam Hussein, for example, we should not be surprised that the Shiites and the Sunnis and the Kurds are fighting against each other. These three elements didn't want to be part of a nation. They were pasted together by the British because of a British interest. So today we live with the consequences of bad decisions that were made by politicians 90 years ago, not really understanding what is life in the Middle East like. Lebanon was created by France, so was Syria. Britain created Jordan, Iraq, Palestine, Saudi Arabia. All these countries are creations of aliens, foreigners, that used to be the empires, but now they are gone. And we try to live with the consequences, and it's not easy. The second observation to make, which is also very important, is the following. Until about 3 centuries ago, Islam was the main power of the world. The Muslim countries extended from India in the east until the very heart of Europe. Vienna was the western border of the Muslim countries. 300 years later, meaning today, look where they are at and look where is the West. They are way behind. They don't understand what went wrong. How come a religion that they consider to be superior to all the others, how come a way of life that they thought is superior to all the others, is so much more advanced today than the Muslim world? They are angry. They feel betrayed. It's payback time. The motivation was always there. What was missing is the technology. And they are doing the best they can to have the technology. And they'll tell us loud and clear, once they have the technology, what is it that they're going to do? We just refuse to listen. Because if we listen, it will demand some action. And this action is war. And nobody wants to think willingly about wars. It's always the last resort. We have to add unfortunately. Because sometimes you can stop something before it grows and pay less price in resources and human lives instead of waiting until it's almost too late, and then the damage is much, much bigger and the loss of lives is much bigger as well. So these two observations are going to be with us for the rest of the evening. Look at the map over there. This is the map of the Middle East until 1922 or so. And tell me, do you see a country called Syria? Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait? They're not there. They're not there for a good reason. They did not exist. The Middle East was part of the Ottoman Empire. Which means if you'd stopped a man in Baghdad, for example, and you would ask him, sir, how do you define yourself? Who are you? He would have told you most likely that he's an Arab, indicating not a religion and not a nationality. The best way to describe Arab is a way of life, a culture. Most likely he was a Muslim, indicating his religion. If you believe in Islam, you're a Muslim. And then you would ask the man, what about your nationality? He would just stare at you. He didn't know that he has a nationality. He was a resident of the Ottoman Empire. If you had stopped a man in Jerusalem, ask him the same question. He would have told you that he is an Arab, most likely a Muslim. But if you would ask him, but you live in a place known as Palestine, are you not Palestinian by your nationality? He would just stare at you. You told him something amazing, that he has a nationality. He was an Arab, Muslim, resident of the Ottoman Empire that happened to live in a province called Palestine. What is the name of the county that you live in? Pima. All right. You're not Pimians by your nationality, right? You're Americans, Christians, I guess, who happen to live in the state of Arizona in the county of Pima. The very same thing back then. So nationalities were not born yet. And here are the countries of the Middle East today. They're all there. But all these nations were created not by the locals. They did not fight for their freedom. They were created by the superpowers that won the First World War. Are you still with me? Because it's getting complicated. This is the simple part, all right? What is the land that we are talking about? Not very big. All right? That's Israel. And you see how small the country is if you compare it to the US of A. 8,000 square miles. That's it. Little smaller than the great state of New Jersey. Now this map gives you an idea about the sizes, but it's not a problem. This one is. Because it shows you Israel in the Middle East, and the map only shows you the Arab countries of the Middle East, not all the Muslim ones. Please make a distinction between Muslims and Arabs, not the same. Most of the Muslims around the world are not Arabs. Indonesia, Malaysia, Nigeria, Iran, Turkey, many millions in India and China, all Muslims, but not Arabs. And therefore, the map only shows you the Arab countries. And as you can tell, 22 Arab countries, and we are right in the middle of it, a very tough neighborhood we live in. And yes, Israel is a secular society maybe, but we all know that without much help from above, that would be impossible. And therefore, the neighborhood that we live in, it's a real challenge to survive. And once again, it looks like against all odds, but of course we know how the book ends, right? We just know the timing. I would like to start the presentation in 1947. As you understand, we don't have time to go into details. I only took a selection of turning points to lead you almost step by step. And I just have you to trust me on this one. I have no interest to give you any kind of propaganda. You will not hear from me that we are the good guys and they are the bad guys. We are always right, always wrong. It's not the case. We just need to know the facts. And people do not know the facts. And people make decisions and pass judgment upon sometimes all kind of stupid ideas that I have no idea where they get it from. My plan tonight is to give you the facts. And you can do with the facts whatever you want. But the least that you own yourselves as an intellectual people, as intelligent human beings, is to know the facts. In 1947, a very important turning point, Israel or Palestine was under a British mandate, a mandate given to Britain by the League of Nations that preceded the UN with one condition, to help the Jews build a homeland in Palestine. That's what the mandate was all about. And your question should be, what about the local Arabs? Arabs also lived in Palestine. How come the world was ignoring their national rights? Well, you know part of the answer, because they did not think in national terms. We speak about tribes and clans, no national leadership, no national agenda. And if you don't see yourself as part of a nation, why would the world give you such recognition? And therefore, the mandate was to help the Jews build a homeland. One thing led to another, and after the Second World War was over, Britain is about to leave Palestine, and by then, there are two enemies fighting against each other, Jews on one side and the Arabs on the other side. It's interesting, but Britain won the war, but lost the empire. The empire started shrinking. And in 1947, February, the British decided to throw this hot potato called Palestine straight into the lap of the UN. You deal with it. We don't know what to do. We're going home. The UN sent a party over. And this party was supposed to find a solution. What can be done? And they came up with a brilliant idea. Partition. Let's take the small land called Palestine, divide it into two. There will be a Jewish state. There will be an Arab state. And Jerusalem, too important to be the capital of any of the two. And therefore, it will be an international city. From the two parties in the struggle, one party said, as bad as the plan is, we'll take it. And this was the Jewish side, because of one reason. These are the years that followed the Holocaust. Survivors of the Holocaust were desperate to go to a place they can call home. Whatever the world was willing to offer, the Jews in Israel, Palestine said, we'll take it. From the Arab side, it was a different message. It's Muslim land. The Jews have no rights on it. And if the British are leaving and the Jews will dare to proclaim their independence, then we'll come and throw them into the ocean. That was always the plan. Us in the ocean. If they were kind enough to throw us into the Dead Sea, it's better. You float. You can't sink in the Dead Sea. But the plan was always the ocean. So 1947, the mandate terminates and the UN decides the two countries will be born. Now, if I had asked you now how many states were born in Palestine after the war of Israel's independence was over, you know the answer, just one, the state of Israel. What happened to the other country? The UN resolution said clearly, two countries. If I had asked you the question, you will have an answer for me, but even without hearing your answer, I'm telling you, you're wrong. Because your answer will be, you conquered their land, and therefore the Palestinian state wasn't born. At least that's what the world thinks all the time. That we called, we stole, we conquered. Not so. As the war started after the British left, the Arab armies invaded Israel's territory. The Jordanians, for example, went into the area that you know today as the West Bank, and that's the green that bulges into the yellow, or we should call it by the biblical name, Judea and Samaria, the very heartland of biblical Israel. This land was allocated to the Palestinians. And after the war was over and the Palestinians demanded that the Jordanians will withdraw, the king of Jordan, Abdullah I, said, it's good land, I'm staying. And therefore, the West Bank was occupied and then annexed officially by the Jordanians. The Egyptians also came to help, at least seemingly, and after the war was over, the area of Gaza that was also allocated to the Palestinians by the UN was in Egyptian hands. And the Palestinians asked them to leave because it was supposed to be their homeland, and Egypt said, no, we are staying. It's very important to understand that because most people don't know. The Palestinian state wasn't born not because of Israel. Because the land that was allocated to them by the UN was now occupied by Arab countries and they refused to hand it over to the Palestinians. One can only imagine what would be the conflict like today if indeed there was a Palestinian state. So next time you hear that the Jews came to steal Arab land, nonsense. The Palestinian state wasn't born because of Jordan and because of Egypt. And these facts are only 60 years old. It's not the Roman era. And most people don't know them. So please know that because these are facts. And I challenge you to challenge the facts. So 1947, 1948, one state was born, the other one was not. 19 years later, the Six-Day War, Israel wins an amazing victory. In 3 days, it triples its territory. The Jordanian army is defeated, the Syrians, the Egyptians. Lebanon was not part of the war of 1967. And we are so proud and arrogant with our great victory that we forgot one very important thing. The land that we now occupy or liberated is not vacant. People live on this land. Who are these people? The very same people that 19 years ago were hoping to become a nation, and their aspirations were in vain because they were crushed by Jordan and by Egypt. Suddenly, they live in a new situation in Israel. You see, if you dare to speak up about your national rights in an Arab dictatorship, you end up with a bullet in your head. If you do that in Israel, that's the name of the game. Democracy, you can say anything you want. We gave them a chance that they've lost 19 years earlier. And we did not understand in 1967 that these people that we thought to be Jordanians and Egyptians might want their rights, and we might have to deal with a nation that was supposed to be born 19 years earlier and was crushed by the Arab countries. That was a big mistake that Israel made, not acknowledging the fact that we might need to deal with people that want to live as a nation. And by the way, many people tell me, and I have to disagree, there was no such thing called Palestinians. You know what, even if you're right, 3.5 million people call themselves a nation. Who am I to tell them you're not? And let's say that I say you're not a nation. Is it going to change something? Are they going to evaporate tomorrow? So it's easy to say, you know what? They don't even have a people. So what? So the sooner we understand that there is a problem over there, the better. And I'm speaking now in the terms of 1967, not today. Today there's no question anymore. So look at the land. And of course, all those places that you know, even from the scriptures, are now in Jewish hands. And the country is 3 times bigger. What a great victory. But the major social and political problem that very conveniently or stupidly we ignored or preferred to ignore back in 1967. So the Six-Day War, as always, was a great military victory followed by other problems. 1979, Israel makes peace with Egypt. The formula was land for peace. We are going to pull out from the Sinai Peninsula. We are going to give it back to the Egyptians. We'll have peace. And we beg them on our knees to take Gaza with them. Gaza was Egypt until 1967. Very cleverly, the Egyptians said, no. You stick with Gaza. We don't want Gaza back. So in 1979, Sinai is given to the Egyptians, and Gaza is now controlled by Israel, or maybe occupied by Israel. In 1988, not a day prior to that, the king of Jordan, King Hussein, suddenly realized that what his grandfather did in 1950 by annexing the West Bank was illegal. It was never really part of Jordan. And therefore, he gives up all the claims, all the rights for the West Bank. Until 1988, many Arab countries did not believe that there is a nation called Palestinians, let alone land that they deserve to have. Because if Jordan said, this is our country, who will dare to tell them among the Arab countries, it's not yours? And therefore, not before 1988, official recognition was given by the Arab world and Israel that there is such a thing as Palestinian people, and they deserve a homeland as well. Because until then, it was Jordan. It was Egypt. So a possible solution, some negotiations, were only possible after the king of Jordan said, I don't want it anymore. Not before 1988. And since he decided not to have it, Israel decided to initiate the first step in what will be known as the peace process in the Middle East between us and the Palestinians. And the question is why? We were not under any pressure. We could carry on with Judea, Samaria, Gaza. Well, because of a few reasons. The first one was that in 1988, Hamas was born, an Islamic Jihad. And we saw the dynamic in the territories, and we understood that the Palestinians are getting more and more religious. The clerics are taking over. There was a majority of fundamental Muslims. And we thought that before it's too late and Islam is taking over, we should make them an offer. You see, the vision was to keep the conflict on the political level. Because as long as we speak about politics, we can negotiate, we can compromise. If you bring it up or down to the religious one, it's a dead end. When the conflict is religious, there's no solution, as simple as that. Because if you're negotiating your God's behalf, He did not authorize you to make any concessions in His behalf, so what is there to talk about? And since we saw the dynamic in their society, we said before it's too late, let's make an offer to the politicians, to the national leaders, not to the clerics. So Israel initiated a peace process. One thing very important to keep in mind, and this is in the Muslim mindset. If you're in conflict with somebody, and he initiates anything that shows generosity, clever politics, whatever, you shouldn't take it. Because the Muslim mindset tells you the following. If somebody offers something like that, he's the weak side. Otherwise, why would he offer any concessions unless he's weak? Which means you need to intensify the pressure because you're winning. Now we know. But when we started this in 1992, 93, it looked like, you know, clever politics. Let's try to find something, some kind of a solution. Each time that Israel offered anything, the immediate result was more pressure. Now we understand. But back then we didn't. An exchange of letters took place between Yitzhak Rabin, Israeli Prime Minister, and Yasser Arafat, the head of the PLO. And the PLO is by definition a national, secular Palestinian movement. The focus is on national and secular, not on religious and not on Muslim. And we recognize Arafat as the leader and the Palestinian people with right to the land. And they, of course, recognize the right of Israel to exist, etc. That was the proclamation, exchange of letters, which made the whole process possible. And then we wake up one morning to see this amazing picture of Arafat and Rabin shaking hands, still shocking even today, 16 years later. And we knew that something was cooking, but we did not know the details yet. The details will be revealed when the leaders are coming back home to try to sell the product, to market it to the people. Because this was still an agreement between leaders. The people didn't know that something was cooking. Politicians did a good job to keep it a secret. Until it was too late in a way, because, you know, hands were shaking. The Oslo Accords, therefore, were supposed to start some kind of a dynamic. You see, the gap was so big, unbridgeable, that if we started negotiating about the core issues, like refugees and borders and Jerusalem, that will kill the process in the very beginning. And therefore, the mindset was the following. Let's create an atmosphere of peace. Let's bring in the light issues. Let's live in peace for 5 years, and after 5 years, after loving peace, we'll bring in the tough issues. But by then it will be easy. Because by then everybody will enjoy peace. And then we'll find a solution. Makes sense, right? It does make sense. So what? Who speaks about sense here? The Middle East and common sense are not good friends. Never were and never will be. So here's what the Oslo Accords are saying basically. They speak about land for peace. How much land is allocated to the Palestinians in the end of the process? The Oslo Accords are not mentioning. It speaks about an autonomy, not a state. A state is a body that is protected by international law, and once a state is created and countries recognize it, a new invader territory, then by international law, you're the aggressor, etc. We said autonomy. And then we'll see. The next stage will be state. We only wanted one thing for the Palestinians. We can give you a lot. What you need to deliver is to show us that you do maximum effort, not success, maximum effort to disarm, to dismantle, to destroy Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and all the others. And then we said that we need to stop the instigation, for example, in the media, which is easy to do. If you want to bring up a new generation to live in peace with your neighbors, you have to start with their kids. Change the textbooks in the schools, because the textbooks are horrible when you look at theirs. We don't teach our people to hate. There's enough hatred without teaching them. But that's a doctrine on the other side. And we said, let's stop that. And then since we knew that we have a lot of ups and downs, it's not going to be easy, we gave it 5 years to see if this is working. And then we said, if we have a problem, all kind of misunderstandings, we'll do what partners do. We'll sit at the table. We'll have a cup of coffee, a slice of cheesecake. We'll talk. That's what partners do. It looked like it's going to work because peace is great. If you had asked me 16 years ago, and I'm the most average Israeli, what is my opinion? I would have told you. Peace is around the corner. Hallelujah. It's coming. It won't be easy, but it made so much sense and brought so many expectations that nobody could deliver. The Oslo Accords were destined to fail because of their vagueness. It doesn't say anything too clearly. And therefore, the people were expecting from both sides something that the other party could not deliver. And therefore, the Oslo Accords were not really working. And when the leaders came back home to deliver the message, even in the beginning of it, there was a problem. Because if you read the message given by Arafat, you should ask me, what are you, deaf? Can't you read Arabic? How come you heard such a message and you carried on? Well, honestly, there was an opposition to the peace talks in both sides. Many Israelis were totally upset with it. And we thought that Arafat is only speaking to his opposition. He doesn't mean that. He's a partner. We shook hands. He will deliver. So we just ignored it. What a big mistake it was, now we know. But in 1993, it looked like it's going to work. Don't even try to understand this map. Look how complicated that is. You're in a complicated situation. You have to be ultra creative to find a solution. This map shows you the West Bank and Gaza. What it says basically is that we are pulling out Israel from the big Palestinian towns. They can have it. And let's see, how do you run your own businesses? And we're very unpleasantly surprised. In 1995, a bomb blasted in the cafeteria in the university in Jerusalem. The man who placed the bomb after the bomb exploded went into his car, drove 20 minutes to Jericho. Jericho was now in Palestinian hands. Israel could not pursue anybody in a land that we respected their sovereignty. And therefore, that was the letter of the agreement. We picked up the phone and called Yasser Arafat, telling him, listen, the man who placed the bomb in the cafeteria, we have good intelligence. Here's the name, here's the address, here's the phone number. He's home now. Go and arrest him. I'll just give you one example. And the answer was, well, if I'll do that, I'll start a civil war. I don't want to have a civil war. These militias are stronger than I am because they are supported by Saudi and by Syria. No Iran yet. I need some help. You know what we did? We helped. We gave him weapons, and quite a lot, that they use today to shoot at us. Because back then we were still partners. He really needed some assistance. And we said, well, we'll do what partners do. We'll offer you assistance. How stupid that was, now we know. But only 12, 13, 14 years ago, it looked like the right thing to do. In other words, it wasn't working. And since it wasn't working, Israel decided to initiate another peace process. And what did we say earlier? What happens when you initiate anything? Why is Israel so generous all of a sudden? Well, maybe because they want to minimize the number of casualties on their side. So why stop now? We are winning. Let's intensify the pressure. The plan that Israel orchestrated was based on what we thought are their demands. For example, we thought that they want a full Israeli withdrawal from where? Well, we thought Judea, Samaria, and Gaza. We thought that they also want the right of all the refugees that fled in 1948 to return. This is not going to happen. If that happens, that's the end of Israel. And we thought that they want that we will release all the prisoners. All their demands were under consideration when Israel made the offer. A summit in Washington, D.C., July of 2000, an Israeli prime minister by the name of Ehud Barak presents his offer. Now make no mistakes. Never in the future, ever, Israel will make a more generous offer than this one. This is our maximum. And we thought that this is so generous that it cannot be turned down. A prime minister of the state of Israel is willing to give Temple Mount and the old city of Jerusalem, most of it, to the Palestinians. This cannot be turned down because it's really generous. Guess what? Then suddenly we understood. If our maximum doesn't meet the minimum, what are we talking about? 7 years earlier, when the process started, they didn't know how much land they're going to get. Israel says now everything basically, and that's not enough. Well, what is enough? Now we understand. Us in the ocean. It was never about two states living side by side. It was them replacing us. And guess what? It's not going to happen. And since the summit had failed, for the next 2 years, we lived in a situation that bombs were placed in synagogues and buses and cafeterias, and human bombs blow themselves to pieces in schools and who knows where else. We lost more than 1,000 people. That's the equivalent of losing 50,000 in this country in 9/11. And why? Why wasn't that enough? Well, why is Israel so generous all of a sudden? And why stop now? If by introducing little terror, that's what we've got, how much more we can get if we intensify the terror? That's the mindset. You need to understand that. Not just in the Middle East, all over the world. If you go to talk to the enemy, you're coming from a weak standpoint. That's their conception. So why stop now? If you take it to the global arena, you do understand that everybody is involved in it. It's just an example. Through this example, you can understand the mindset all around the world, not just in the Middle East. So, since it wasn't working, the U.S. decided to get deeper involved. America's position until 2002, when President Bush gave his speech, was that the Middle Eastern conflict should be dealt, negotiated by the local parties. America said that we are going to help, facilitate, offer assistance, anything you want. Everything that you agree upon, you have our blessing. But we don't want to be deeply involved. When the Bush administration started in 2000, the U.S. tried very much not to be involved in the Middle East. But after 9/11, of course, it was dragged in, if you wish, for the first time with boots on the ground. And therefore, President Bush decided to replace the Oslo Accords by his own plan, which is known, and this is the plan even today, the roadmap for peace in the Middle East. And when President Bush said it was always America's vision to see a two-state solution, no, it was not, until he said it loud and clear in that speech. You know what? Not a bad idea, by the way. Since we cannot get along well, maybe somebody needs to come from the outside and say, that's the plan. Take it or leave it. And guess what happened? We said, hey, we'll take it. And so did the Palestinians. Nobody wants to stand against the US of A. But we said that we'll take it because of one reason. It's not a good plan for Israel. But this plan had a precondition. It's not going into effect unless the Palestinians are destroying their own terror militias. And since by then they didn't want to, or they were not capable to, Israel would be under no obligation to deliver any of it. And we were right, by the way. So officially the plan today is a roadmap for peace in the Middle East. So 2002, the world is getting deeper and deeper involved in what should be a solution, a two-state solution. And since a lot of things happened, and we wanted to protect our people if possible, we have established some facts on the ground. For example, building a fence, it's a smart fence. You know what? You can say that Israel is a gated community. Why do you people live in gated communities, huh? You want to leave the bad guys out? That's what you want to do. So we build a fence. The world media calls it a wall. A wall, it's a fence. 500 miles long, and to be totally honest with you, 5% of it is indeed a concrete wall. Whenever the Palestinian homes are too close to ours, we don't want anybody to shoot through the fence. Jerusalem, you'll be disappointed to hear, is divided already by a concrete wall, separating the Palestinian neighborhoods from the others. Very effective. It saves lives on both sides. And we told them very clearly, you come closer to the fence, we'll shoot you. You want to come and work in Israel? Go to the border crossings. Israel issues 30,000 working permits every day for Palestinians to come and work. We don't want them to starve to death. We need content neighbors. But we have the right to protect our people. And the fence is working very well. It won't stop rockets, but it will stop people from going through and carrying a bomb in their pockets, for example. So the fence is going to be, when it is completed, which is not the case yet, going to be a really a big improvement. And the world is very upset with it, by the way. How dare you build a fence? What do you mean, how dare us? Isn't there a fence between Mexico and California? For much less reasons? Nobody seems to be upset about that. The other thing that happened is that Yasser Arafat died, leaving a total chaos behind him in Gaza. You need to understand that the regime under Arafat was working in a very odd way. Gaza has today, and had back then, about 30 to 35 clans, gangs, militias, whatever. Each one was responding directly to Arafat, not to the cabinet. The Palestinian cabinet has no authority over those gang leaders. They played allegiance, so to speak, to the man individually. Once he died, chaos prevailed because they refused to be loyal to the man that replaced him. Nobody controls what happens in Gaza, not even Hamas sometimes. Total chaos. Same thing in Judea and Samaria. The death of Arafat, therefore, really told us what is it that we're up against. Nobody represents everybody, so you're negotiating with somebody that doesn't represent all the people, so what's the point? Meanwhile, Israel decided to take it another step further. 2005, we decide to pull out from Gaza. Now the question is why? Is that the way to fight terror? Pulling out from Gaza, isn't it rewarding terror? Yes. You know what? As much as I hate to admit, sometimes terror wins. Sometimes they win. They cannot win the war. But sometimes it looks like they're winning. You have no idea how much they were encouraged by Israel's step. Because they understood the step, not clever politics once again, but Israel is weak. The Israeli public pressurized the government to reduce the casualties. So why stop now if it's working? There were two reasons for the disengagement. First one was that 1.4 million Palestinians live in the Gaza Strip, and there were 18 Israeli communities, little pockets, surrounded by a very hostile area. You know what? If somebody wanted to visit a friend in a nearby community, the family car was escorted by a tank. Do you understand that? People went to work in convoys of 10, 15 cars escorted by helicopters. In many cases, a regiment of elite infantry troops was protecting a community of 40 families. We could no longer guarantee their safety. They didn't ask to be evacuated, by the way. Very committed, very zealous. But Israel has a responsibility to protect its citizens. And there was another reason. The world still thought in 2005 that if Israel will just give up a little more, it will satisfy the Palestinians. And we said, really? Well, let's put it to a test. We are going to leave Gaza, and let's see what happens. Well, guess what happened? We were not surprised, by the way. You know what? Since 2005, Israel is under no political pressure. No country in the world will think today that Israel needs to give more. Now it's their turn to deliver the minimum, something, to sow some kind of goodwill. Not even that. So the disengagement gave a lot of credit to Israel, but practically, more rockets, more violence, more terror. Because now we were not in Gaza, and you don't know how easy it is to launch a Qassam rocket. Very primitive, not very advanced, short range. Takes about 10 seconds. You can do it right here from the courtyard. Doesn't take too much sophistication. And now without us monitoring the area every day for the last 8 years, because it started even before that, Israel was rocketed by more than 9,000 mortar shells and rockets. And when they usually fire, 7:45 a.m. What happens 7:45 a.m.? The kids go to school and they tell you loud and clear, we want to take out as many Jews as possible. The world accuses us for killing innocent civilians. I never heard anybody condemning Hamas for doing that. They say, oh, they're Arabs. We are holding you of much higher moral standard. All this double standard, just mind-blowing. So 2005 gave us a lot of credit politically. But on the ground, more rockets, more violence. It wasn't really helping. Pulling out from Gaza, as we just said, was maybe good politically, but it left us with a major problem, and that's a crossing into Egypt. Gaza is a very small place, 25 miles long, about 6, maybe 7 miles wide, 1.4 million people. Gaza City is the most dense area on earth. I'll show you a picture in a minute. You can't even see that these are houses because it's just a total maze. The problem is that nobody controls the border between Gaza Strip and Egypt. Well, the Egyptians supposed to, but they couldn't care less. And therefore, there was a constant flow of weapons, ammunition, into Gaza from Egypt. And the Egyptians that were commanded to stop that did absolutely nothing. Now, we could, of course, accuse the Egyptians. If we would have done that, that would lead to a political crisis, and we are allies, we live in peace. We don't want to offend the famous Arab honor to criticize President Mubarak, the head of the Arab countries. So like a bunch of idiots, we decided not to. Everything came in from Egypt. And when we brought up the issue very delicately, said, from Egypt? No. Where else from? We control the land, we control the sea, we control the air, but not from Egypt. And by the way, with the Palestinians, all of them are innocent civilians. All of them. 9,000 bombs just fell off the sky, miraculously. Nobody launched them. Each time that you speak about casualties, innocent civilians. Gaza is a place that has tens of thousands of rockets inside. We took out quite a lot over the last 5 weeks or so. But we still have quite a lot as well. And everything comes in from Egypt. Now the Egyptians are very careful because the whole world is demanding them to stop that. The border, by the way, goes through a town called Rafah. Now my house is here and my cousin lives about 100 yards away on the other side. So I start digging a tunnel from my living room and I go straight into his kitchen. And if I missed, into his bathroom. But this is a family project. And from the Palestinian side or the Egyptian side, you bring to your cousin, you know, two big sacks full of TNT, and it goes into the tunnel and into Gaza. Multiply that by 500 to 600. Every day, tons. Not food, not pharmaceutics, not something to help the people. Weapons, ammunition, guns, rockets. And we knew that, and we knew that a time will come that we'll have to go inside to clear that. They did not collect the weapons to build the weapon museum. They collected weapons to use them. So with the Egyptians, we had a little problem. Look how easy it is to bring things into Gaza. Either from Iran or Somalia, and watch Somalia. Somalia is the next Afghanistan. No doubt. An Arab Muslim country, a very weak central government, today, many groups of Al-Qaeda, for example, are training in Somalia. That will be the next problem of the West, just like Afghanistan. Everything goes in, unstopped, through Egypt's sovereign territory. Aren't they accountable for something? God forbid, not the Egyptians. It doesn't go in from our territory. Miraculously appears in Gaza. Now it changed. Now it's going to be totally different. But until about 2 months ago, that was the Egyptian standpoint. We don't know how it goes in, but not through Egypt. Of course, only through Egypt. If I sound a little bit bitter and frustrated, I have a good reason to, okay? No, that's a tunnel. Looks very innocent, very primitive. When you go downstairs, it's ventilated, it's littered, they have railroads, so you can really push these heavy carts with everything. It goes from one house to the other. By the way, over the last 2 months or so, we cleared an area along the border. Cleared meaning destroying homes. And with big bombs, the bunker busters, destroying many of those tunnels. We didn't take all of them out. But we caused so much damage. It would be very hard for many of these tunnels to reoperate. Israel is facing a very big dilemma. And you need to understand it because many friends of Israel, and I'm sure that most of you are, have a big problem to understand why Israel is doing things. Let me try to present without justifying, yes or no, just to show you what is our big dilemma. We have an option to annex Judea and Samaria. We have an option to go into Gaza. We are capable of doing that and retake Gaza. If we do that, we are creating a major problem because by demographics, we will be outnumbered in our own country. The population of Israel is 7.2 million, including 1.5 million Palestinians. The only Arabs in the Middle East that live in democracy are the Israeli Arabs. 1.8 in the West Bank, 1.4 in Gaza. If we annex the territories, that's the end of our country. Now you can tell me, how about annexing the land and don't give the people the right to vote? That's apartheid. And we don't want to live in an apartheid state, regardless of President Carter's book, Israel equals apartheid. How dare he? He apologized, by the way. But it was too late. Once the book was written, that's it. The other option is to have a smaller Israel. To give up land, yes, not for negotiations. Not because you want to reward them, because it's good for Israel. And to create a country which is smaller in territory, maybe, but has a solid Jewish majority. We have elections in 3 weeks. All the leading parties are for the second plan. They only differ about how to get there. And there are a few options, obviously. But many Israelis will tell you that if that's a price to pay to guarantee our existence as a homeland for the Jews with a solid Jewish majority, so be it. Because in the modern era, land is not that important. We can shoot a rocket from 5,000 miles away. Who cares about another strip of 20 miles of land? So from our perspective, the options are quite limited. But right now, that's a plan. And by the way, if we do that, it doesn't mean that we give up the biblical promise. No. We do know what the Bible teaches us. We do know that we are there because God keeps His promises. We do know that once a time will come on God's timing, and yes, the children of Abraham will inherit the promised land. When? We don't know. But right now, we want to save lives. Right now, we want to make sure that we minimize the conflict because too much blood was shed already. Elections in the Palestinian autonomy. Another big mistake that we did, when I say we, that's the U.S. and Israel as well. But in the spirit of democracy, everybody had a right to vote. And we warned the Bush administration saying, listen, if Hamas participates, they will win. It was obvious. But the idea was, if it's a democracy, everybody has the right to be part of it. And guess what happened? Hamas won. Not only won, but big time. 74 members in the parliament of 132. When it happened in January of 2006, exactly 3 years ago, some people said, not bad. Hamas's leaders will have all the responsibilities of a state. They'll be too occupied in building schools, developing an industry, sewage. No, they were not. All the money that the world was giving, and it was giving quite a lot, was used to buy weapons, to train more militias. Because that's what happened. It did create a terror state, a terror entity, Hamastan it was called, right? In the Gaza Strip. So if you were hoping that Hamas's victory might turn to a more positive way, we were wrong. So now we have a nation called the Palestinians, divided into two entities, Gaza and the West Bank, fighting against each other. They're not even a nation, not even a country, I'm sorry, and already a civil war. Because the PLO, the leaders, decided just a minute, this election was such a big mistake. And they refused to surrender the weapons, for example. Hamas is right. We won the elections. We are the new regime. The PLO said, oops, mistake. By the way, people voted. It was their choice. Voting for a party, a group of people, that their agenda in their charter says very clearly, the destruction of the state of Israel. It's no longer a hidden agenda. They don't try to appear as honest politicians to get more from Israel. They tell you loud and clear, we have the right to destroy Israel by using any means. They also demand us to keep supplying them with electricity and food and pharmaceuticals. Do you understand the irony here? Everything Gaza has is coming from us. The Egyptians, they also have a border, they can supply Gaza with everything Gaza needs. They don't do that. We do that. And you should tell me, what are you, crazy? Cut off the power, for example. Because my taxes are paying for electricity that we are giving Gaza so they can, in their workshops, manufacture rockets to fire at us. And you should say, cut off the power. You're right. And we did. Only once. Guess what happened? Al Jazeera, Al Arabiya, BBC, CNN, all those fancy names, went to the local hospital to show the world how Palestinian babies are dying in their incubators because the Jews cut off the power. Well, how do you win that? You can't. And in the very same time, Hamas's vehicles were running freely. There's a lot of fuel in Gaza. But why not to exploit the propaganda that the whole world is offering? We do live in a very unusual situation, as you understand. So cutting off the power, not an option. Because it will be not well taken by the world. We still care about what the world thinks, but not for too long, as you will see in a minute. Three gentlemen are running the show now on the Palestinian side. The one on the right-hand side, President Mahmoud Abbas, PLO. The man is officially the head of the state. He is a powerless politician. Hamas does not recognize his position. He is giving orders to nobody, and nobody takes orders from him. Yet since he is the official leader, we are negotiating with him about what? About nothing. There's no substance. Because he cannot deliver absolutely nothing. But hey, we don't talk to terrorists, right? So we don't talk to Hamas. They don't want to talk to us as well. So what are we exactly we're talking about? About nothing. The man in the center, Ismail Haniyeh, just crawled out from his bunker the other day, claiming, victory! We won the war against Israel. Nonsense. He is the leader of Hamas in Gaza. But the man that really has all the power is the man on the left-hand side, Khaled Mashal. He's in Damascus. He's all the money. He's in control, basically. When the man in the middle was begging for ceasefire 3 weeks ago, the man on the left was sitting in his office in Damascus, smoking a cigar, enjoying a cup of cappuccino. Oh, don't surrender. Carry on. Within Hamas, there was a problem. Hamas Gaza is not cooperating too well with Hamas Damascus. So it's not just Israel and Palestinians. The Palestinians are divided into three groups and they don't get along with each other well. Now who are we supposed to talk to? Who will be a partner that can deliver? Nobody. So what's the point in talking? And since Hamas was getting stronger and stronger, and since the PLO decided not to give up, there was a civil war, and Hamas won big time. We had to take the PLO people from Gaza before they were butchered by the Hamas and move them to the West Bank. And because Hamas are so bad, suddenly the PLO, the friends, they are the good guys. The PLO and Israel today are allies, and Hamas is a common enemy. So today, Gaza is in the hands of Hamas, and the PLO is controlling the West Bank. And that's how Gaza City looks like, right? Can you see that? These are homes and houses. The roads in some parts of Gaza are only as wide as a man's shoulders. That's it. That's Gaza. 1.4 million people live like that. So, two groups. By the way, they were supposed to have elections this month. They were postponed. And make no mistakes, in free elections in the West Bank, Hamas might win there as well. Because fundamentalist Islam is getting stronger and bigger in Egypt and in Syria and in Jordan, Al-Qaeda, Muslim Brotherhood, World Jihad, all the same. Forget about the names. It's all the same. The motivation, the same motivation. And it's not easy to understand or to accept. So easy to ignore. Doesn't happen. Yes, it does. Getting stronger and stronger. This was a fiasco, so I don't want to speak about it. Since the elections, the world is boycotting Hamas. No country in the world, except for Iran and Syria, officially recognized the leadership of Hamas in Gaza. Which means that since we don't recognize Hamas and they don't recognize us, and they refuse to keep the agreement that we signed with the PLO, and they have the right to wipe out Israel and still demand that we supply them with everything they need, you're in a situation which is impossible. But the whole world is justifying the Israeli case. Israel is under no pressure, by the way. Even in the last conflict in Gaza, we were accused for using disproportional force, whatever that is. but not about the right to go and take out Hamas. There's no question about that. Even the Arab countries are very much for it. Because Hamas is bad news for the Egyptians and the Saudis and Jordanians. They want to see the end of it. So these elections totally isolated Hamas. Not that it did something good in a way, but we do see, or we're noticing and seeing how things are changing under our very noses, and we did not take action because there was no immediate reason, so to speak. We still waited. I know it's totally bizarre. But if one rocket would hit a kindergarten and would kill 20 Israeli kids, that was the justification that we needed. It didn't happen. Thank goodness for that. So we waited for the excuse. In December of 2005, there was a truce between Hamas and Israel through Egypt. Everything that we do through the Egyptians. 6 months. And we knew that these 6 months are going to be exploited by them, not to build more schools and to create more jobs, but to bring in more weapons. Until 6 months ago, the most advanced rocket of Hamas would fire to 5 miles. That's it. What they were using now, 2 weeks ago, would fire to 30 miles. And everything was brought in from Egypt under the nose of the Egyptians by bribing Egyptian officials into Gaza. The truce was over officially the 19th of December, last year. That means 6 weeks ago. At midnight, when it was over, rockets were fired at Israel. And we said, stop it, we won't take it. More rockets. For 10 days, it was a cat and mouse game. Stop it because we retaliate. Until enough was enough, and we moved in. And we moved in brutally. We did things that Israel never did before. But the idea was to deliver a message. And the message has to be understood. Was it yes or no? Too early to tell. For the first time, Israel was really fighting with gloves off. If until then, if a Hamas member would carry a baby in his arms, and that's how they walk around Gaza, babies in their arms, we would not take them out. Since this operation, we will, including the baby. Am I happy about it? I'm not. If we knew that there is a house with somebody that we want, but the whole family is there, we will spare the life of the man and his family. Not anymore. We'll take out him and the family and the house and the street and the neighborhood if necessary. And we did. We caused enormous damage in Gaza. They only now begin to understand what Hamas brought to Gaza. And the locals are not idiots. They also understand Hamas is a disaster. And Hamas refused to engage. We speak about militants that were bragging that if Israel dares to launch a ground operation, they will cause hundreds of casualties. Israel will never dare to go to refugee camps. I'm embarrassed to tell you how many people we lost. 2. Alright? And 8 to friendly fire. They evaporated. And one reason was, in the aftermath of the conflict, they need to protect the regime because the people will not take it anymore. And if we had taken out most of their people, they could not protect themselves anymore, and that's the main interest. Make no mistakes. Suffering and hunger in Gaza is good for Hamas. They don't want to do anything to help their people. That's how they live. That's how they make a living. By complaining to the world all the time. Look how poor we are. You know what? If you voted for somebody like that, if you shield yourself with a baby, his blood is on your hands. And we are sick and tired to apologize to the whole world all the time. We moved in brutally for the first time ever, and I hope that for the last time as well. Nobody liked what happened. But the message had to be clear. We are not going to take it anymore. The whole idea was to have a tag, a price tag. One more rocket. And Gaza is out. They just have to understand the message. Will they? I don't know. So far they did nothing that made sense. If they would say, listen, we are willing to talk to Israel, they cannot call themselves Hamas anymore. Because Hamas, by definition, is going to destroy Israel. which is not going to happen, obviously. But do understand our position as well. What are we supposed to do? For 8 years, 9,000 rockets and mortar shells, day by day by day, you send your kid to school and you don't know if he's going to make it. Just imagine the following, right? Somebody in Mexico says that the purchase of California wasn't really legal. And a local gang will launch rockets from Tijuana to San Diego. What will America do the following day? Let me tell you. Okay? Why can't we do the same? Everything we had to do, leaving territories, initiating peace processes, we did. What else? But we also begin to understand something else. We will live by the sword for a long, long time. If we were hoping, when we started the peace process, that maybe something might happen, no. It's not going to happen. We'll see another round, and another round, and another one. That's the way it's going to be. We just have to, you know, maybe to get used to live with it. And make no mistakes, because it's us. If the message that we delivered is not clear enough, it will happen everywhere. And they tell us loud and clear, that's our plan. We just refuse to listen. Interesting, but the Arab countries stood with Israel. When was the last time that Saudi and Jordan and Egypt and Israel had the same interest? Because Hamas is bad news for the whole region. Muslim nations have one main enemy, and that's fundamentalist Muslims. You see, to speak about Muslim nations is almost an oxymoron. Islam doesn't believe in nations. Islam believes in one entity, including all the Muslims around the world, under the leadership of a caliph, which is a cleric, not in nations. Muslim nationalities are violating the spirit of Islam. And therefore, every Muslim country, every Arab regime, has a major problem from this opposition, the Muslim Brotherhood. In Egypt, where they have a limited democracy, the last elections, 30% of the members in the parliament are Muslim Brotherhood. Under free elections, Egypt is gone. It's no longer a nation. It will be a Muslim entity. And it will be. Same as Lebanon. Lebanon is officially controlled by Hezbollah. Because today, out of cabinet of 30 members, 11 members are Hezbollah. And the constitution says that you cannot pass a law unless you have 2/3 of the votes. Hezbollah can decide how to run the country because they have 11 members out of 30. And it's the same everywhere. I'm sorry that this message is not more optimistic, but once again, we just need to face the reality. And as much as we ignore it, it's not going to help. Read the following message because they mean it. Just read it for a second, all right? That's the motivation. That's the plan. They say it loud and clear. They will not rest until they accomplish that. Unless we'll take the first step. And what we did in Gaza is supposed to be the beginning of a domino effect. It was a slap on the face of Iran. I'm sure that the lights are on until very late in offices in Tehran. Try to figure out how come the system didn't work. How come the Israelis did not lose that many casualties. What went wrong? Well, we've learned. We came prepared this time, unlike in Lebanon 2.5 years ago. We knew what we were doing. In military schools around the world, every army will study what we did in Gaza. Because it was a tremendous success from a military point of view. You know that half of the city was wired? Houses of people, innocent civilians, were wired, where people live in. And the idea was to detonate bombs where people are in. If you can take some Israeli lives as well. But they did not know that we have the technology how to detect those buildings, how to take them out before they detonate the bombs. And they were shocked. How can we do that? They spoke about hundreds of Israeli casualties. At least 50 tanks we're going to destroy. Not even one was scratched. Because we came prepared. Not important. Very important, but not for today. Just looking at the watch. Just look at that. And I think that one word or one picture is better than everything you heard so far, right? You see the bottom? That's it. That's exactly it. And we are accused for, you know, killing casualties. Just civilians. Just some examples, all right, of the last 10 years. Not more than that. About who killed innocent civilians. I don't recall the world demonstrating against NATO when thousands of Yugoslavs and Serbs were bombed by NATO. Innocent civilians. Did anybody demonstrate it? And when exactly the last Serb bombed a bomb in Paris, for example? Only when it comes to the Middle East. There's one party that's always blamed. So we gave up. We don't want to find favor in the eyes of anybody. If I have to choose between good press and safety, I choose safety. Simple, huh? Well, when this little conflict ended, I think it's very clear what we wanted to accomplish. We want to make sure about two things. Number one, the restoration of Gaza is not done by Iran, very important, by anybody else, but not Iran, because with the money comes influence. You know what happened in Lebanon? In Lebanon, when somebody's house was destroyed in 2006, you have two options to rebuild the house. You can go to the government and fill up the paperwork and wait until somebody will come to fix your house. Or, across the road, there was a desk over there with a man behind the desk. And he has a suitcase full of cash sent from Iran. Sign a piece of paper, $40,000 in your hands. What would you choose? Same thing here. We will do whatever possible that Iranian money is not going to be involved. And number two, the whole world made a commitment, a promise, that the whole world is going to donate technology to the Egyptians so they would stop the flow of weapons. Finally, Egypt acknowledged the fact that everything goes in from Egypt. And they also understood something very important. You can fire a rocket to Israel, but also into Egypt. So now the whole world is united around this issue. No more weapons in Gaza. Is it realistic? Maybe not totally. And maybe in 5 years we'll have to move back in and to wipe out half of Gaza. Maybe that will be the dynamic. It's a possibility. But once you set a precedent, it won't be as bad as it was now. Maybe that will be this vicious circle between us and the Palestinians. If that's a price to pay, we are willing to pay it. The question is, are they willing to pay? Because if that goes like that, pretty soon there won't be any Palestinians left. And we're not kidding. I mean, we really mean business now. We took out mosques, for example. We never did that. You know what happens? Then you saw, maybe you showed the pictures. The rocket hits the mosque, and right after the mosque explodes, there is an extravaganza of fireworks. What are these fireworks? The rockets under the mosque exploding. Same thing with houses. We took out houses of innocent civilians. And guess what? The house exploded with huge fireworks. Why? Because in the third floor the family lived, in the second floor was a workshop, in the basement were the rockets. Innocent civilians. I would like to stop here, if that's okay with you. We can go on and on and on. But we don't have all the time in the world. So, we didn't speak about the whole Middle East, not only about us and the Palestinians. And once again, you need to watch carefully what happens. Because what happens in our area is an example. What are the dynamics on a global scale of radical Islam? They have a purpose and they won't quit until they either accomplish that or we destroy them. You want to negotiate as a new administration? Fine, maybe it will work. I'm not criticizing, I'm not making any comments on American politics. Maybe it will work. But since we begin to understand what's the motivation of the other side, what exactly are we going to talk about? Let's try to picture this dialogue. An American ambassador and somebody from Iran. What is it that you want? We want you to stop, you know, producing nuclear weapons. Oh, we have the right to do that. End of discussion. End of discussion. Especially in light of the fact that they say how they're going to use that once they have it. You know, North Korea, you could buy them out. They needed money. You offered money, fine. It wasn't an ideological issue. With Iran, it's all about ideological issue, not about money. So what is it that we're going to talk about? We'll wait and see. Maybe it will work. Maybe. Based on past experience, it's not going to work. So maybe I'll be standing here 3 years from now if Pastor Junho will still invite me. And I told you, I was so wrong 3 years ago. You see, we live in peace. We are friends. Well, let's be realistic about it, huh? And let's wait. Let's see what happens in 3 years. Thank you for coming. If you have any questions, please.